This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
Stay tuned for our bulletin of church news, which will be followed by Panorama, and then our feature, Culture and Society. We shall close with the news for young people. I am John Baptist Tumusime. The Holy See Press Office issued a brief statement on Thursday morning updating the health condition of Pope Francis. It said the Pope had a peaceful night and was resting in his room at Gemelli Catholic Hospital, where he was admitted for pneumonia on February 14th. The statement follows another one which was issued on Wednesday evening, which said that the condition of the Holy Father remained stable throughout the day and that he underwent high-flow oxygen therapy and non-invasive mechanical ventilation would be resumed during the night. Meanwhile, because of his ill health, Pope Francis was not able to preside over Holy Mass on Ash Wednesday at the Basilica of Santa Sabina in Rome, as has been the custom. Instead, he sent Cardinal Angelo De Donatis, the former auxiliary bishop of the Diocese of Rome, who presided over the liturgy and also read his homily. In the homily, the Pope reminded the faithful that we human beings experience fragility through illness, poverty, and the hardships that can suddenly befall us and our families. But Lent is an invitation to rekindle our hope. In the Lenten season, the Pope said, we are invited to lift our eyes to Christ, who rose from the depth of death and brought us from the ashes of sin and death to the glory of eternal life. The Auxiliary Bishop of Beira Catholic Archdiocese in Mozambique, the Right Reverend Antonio Bogaio, has called on religious men and women to accept their vocation as a sign of Christ's victory over human challenges. He made the call on Sunday in Holy Mass at the Sacred Heart of Jesus Parish, during which Sister Dorcas Kawandi of the Franciscan Sisters of Our Lady of Victory took her final vows. Bishop Bogaio emphasized that religious life is a commitment that shines the light of Christ in the world. While acknowledging the challenges in religious life, the bishop called upon the religious to be living witnesses of Christ in society. The Catholic bishops of Liberia have called upon the country's citizens and political leaders to work towards unity, warning that divisions based on political affiliations, tribal and regional lines are hindering progress. The call was contained in a pastoral letter for the Lenten season that the bishops issued a few days ago. The bishops observed that deepening divisions within the social fabric of the Liberian society have given way to favoritism, nepotism, discrimination, and other vices. They called for conversion and reconciliation during the Lenten period. Protestant and Catholic religious leaders in Uganda have called upon the government and especially state security agencies to respect human rights. The call comes after security officers mounted attacks on two consecutive days against members of the opposition during by-election campaigns in the capital Kampala to fill a parliamentary seat that fell vacant after the death of a member of parliament. Security officers wearing masks beat up opposition supporters and broke the arm of an opposition candidate. They also attacked a television journalist who was covering the violence and caused serious harm on one of his eyes. the Archbishop of the Anglican Church of Uganda, His Grace Stephen Samuel Kazimba Mugalu, condemned the brutality and called upon security agencies to review their approach. The Archbishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Kampala, His Grace Poste Mogerere, also condemned the violence and advised the government not to be afraid of elections. Archbishop Semogerere called upon politicians to desist from hate speech. Uganda will hold general elections next year. The current wave of violence, according to political analysts in the country, is meant to intimidate the opposition. You are tuned to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
I am Father Paul Samasumo. Mali's government says it has suspended the granting of new small-scale mining permits to foreigners after a number of accidents in recent weeks left dozens dead. The collapse on the 15th of February of a small gold mine killed 43 people, mostly women. There have been several other mining accidents. In response to the mining accidents and the deaths, Mali's Council of Ministers has decided to suspend the granting of small-scale mining permits to foreigners. Mali is one of Africa's gold producers and home to large-scale transnational industrial mining as well as small-scale mining, mostly owned by foreigners who employ locals. Arab leaders have approved a reconstruction plan for Gaza, spearheaded by Egypt in collaboration with Palestine. The initiative, now recognized as an official Arab League proposal, rejects any forced displacement of Palestinians, as suggested by U.S. President Donald Trump. The plan includes clearing debris, restoring essential services, and securing international funding through a trust overseen by the World Bank. It also proposes a long-term urban development. In the meantime, Egypt is set to host an international conference in cooperation with the United Nations to galvanize global support. The Arab League has also called on the UN Security Council to deploy an international peacekeeping force in Gaza and the West Bank. Guinea-Bissau's President Umaro Embalo has announced his intention to run for a second term in November. Guinea-Bissau was scheduled to hold presidential elections in December 2024. However, on the 4th of November, President Embalo postponed the elections in unclear circumstances, leading to much political tension and uncertainty. Some observers claim President Embalo's electoral mandate actually expired last month in February. Meanwhile, a delegation from West Africa's regional bloc, ECOWAS, arrived in Guinea-Bissau to help resolve the country's political crisis. For his part, President Embalo says he has survived two attempts to overthrow his government in the last 3 years. You are tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
This is Culture and Society, and you are welcome to the program. My name is Kanyan Tagodufri Kampamba. Peacekeeping is an instrument developed by the United Nations as a way to help countries torn by conflict to create the conditions for lasting peace. Peacekeepers therefore monitor and observe peace processes in post-conflict areas and assist ex-combatants in implementing the peace agreements that they may have signed. Such assistance comes in many forms, including separating former combatants, confidence-building measures, power-sharing arrangements, electoral assistance, strengthening the rule of law, and economic and social development. Accordingly, United Nations peacekeepers can include soldiers, police officers, and civilian personnel. And according to Jean-Pierre Lacroix, the Under-Secretary General of Peace Operations, there are many good reasons for increasing the number of women peacekeepers in United Nations missions. In February this year, Lacroix attended the first ever conference for women peacekeepers held in the Indian capital, New Delhi. Speaking at that conference, the Under-Secretary General argued the fact that Changing the gender balance benefits the work environment in peacekeeping missions, improving conduct and discipline. In fact, he expressed his conviction that more women peacekeepers translate into better United Nations missions. In this edition today, we hear Lacroix speaking in an interview with Anshu Sharma from the United Nations News on the sidelines of that conference for women peacekeepers in India, explaining his belief about women improving the role of peacekeeping missions in society.
From front lines to leadership, what do you think, what would it take for women to be the face of UN peacekeeping?
We are doing better when it comes to the number of women serving in peacekeeping, and our number or the proportion of women has been constantly improving. Now, there are a couple of issues on which we need to do more work. One of them is that we would want to have more senior female officers for senior positions, such as force commander, deputy force commanders. Now, not many armed forces have many women at this kind of level. It's a very gradual process. And India is doing a lot to achieve that and also provide us with more female officers. Well, I think that is one thing that we obviously need to have more work done on. But then in addition to that, we have to look at how we make the peacekeeping environment welcoming for women and for men, basically, and that has to do with the practical issues such as the facilities. And there is also a psychological dimension, how to make sure that all the peacekeepers, men and women, do their best to make the work environment of peacekeeping welcoming to all, and certainly to female peacekeepers. We are working on this, but I think it's also a responsibility, a shared responsibility that we have with the troop and police contributing countries.
What would you say is the biggest barrier to the advancement of women in peacekeeping, and how do we break it?
You know, we have a UN policy which is about empowering women, and it's across the board, and I think empowering women in peacekeeping is part of that policy. We also believe, as I told you, that we have a more effective peacekeeping when we have more women in peacekeeping. First of all, because we generate a better work environment in peacekeeping. We also, that helps to empowering women in the countries or the territories in which peacekeeping missions are deployed, because when the women see, you know, that our missions have women in different roles, then they that helps in terms of empowering them, and in a way those female peacekeepers are role models. It's particularly important also to have more women in peacekeeping when it comes to building trust with the communities, and that is something that has been regularly sort of said about more women peacekeeping. But we don't limit this to sort of better engagement with communities. We have female officers, you know, helicopter pilots. We are very open to all kind of works, every task that we have in peacekeeping are open to women as well as to men. And finally, I believe that we have a better record on conduct and discipline when we have more women in peacekeeping.
So how do you think countries of the Global South, and especially India, can play a more active role in peacekeeping?
The majority of the peacekeepers that we have deployed are coming from the Global South, and India is one of the biggest troop contributing countries. And I believe that their role is critically important, and not only in terms of their contribution in numbers, but as far as India is concerned, we very much look to India with its specific capacities to help us in terms of all the efforts that are currently being carried out to improve peacekeeping, to improve safety and security, to improve how we use digital technology. Of course, when it comes to improving the number of women in peacekeeping, improving how performance assessment is being carried out and all this. I think there's a wealth of experience in countries like India, which we really want to take advantage of, you know, through collective work, so that we keep adapting peacekeeping, because there are so many challenges. We need to work with the purpose of making sure that tomorrow peacekeeping operation will continue to be relevant.
When you're talking about new technologies, we also have AI, we have cyber threats now, we have drones. So how do you think peacekeeping should evolve to stay ahead of all these threats?
But that is a critical objective, and that is the reason why we have launched what we call the strategy for the digital transformation of peacekeeping, with a number of key priorities having to do with how, through digital technology, we improve situational awareness, we improve the safety and security of our peacekeepers, and also we counter mis- and disinformation, which are currently weaponized in many peacekeeping settings. But there is a lot of work to do to achieve those objectives, and one important objective, or in a way it's a prerequisite, is we have to elevate the level of digital literacy amongst our staff. And that will require a lot of work in terms of training, in terms of elevating this level of preparedness. And we cannot do that alone as the UN Secretariat. We need to work with partners. India has very strong capacities in that field, and I've shared with my interlocutors in India how important it would be to increase our collaboration on that particular topic.
So apart from new technologies, what is the other, the biggest, I would say, the threat to peacekeeping in the next 20 years, and how do we prepare for it today?
Well, I think the biggest challenge really is the division of our member states. It's a political challenge because we rely on strong and united political support by our member states. And unfortunately today, that unity is less there, and that impacts peacekeeping and in different ways. The existing peacekeeping mission are less, cannot always count on the strong and united support from the member states, particularly from the Security Council, when they encounter challenges and difficulties, particularly with the host governments or host parties. So that's one thing. The other thing is that peacekeeping deployment are deployed, the peacekeeping operations are deployed to support political efforts. But for those political efforts to succeed, we also need a united and committed, strong international community. So that is another aspect. Now, we're facing other kind of challenges. Right? I repeat, the political one is the most important, but we're facing challenges having to do with how conflicts have evolved with more non-state actors, today private security companies, the role of drivers of conflict, such as transnational criminal activities, or terrorism, the impact of climate change, all of this. And, of course, the negative impact of digital technology. So all of this is affecting us, and we have to adapt to what we can adapt. I mean, we cannot control the level of unity of our member states, but we have to control, and we have to work on addressing all these issues having to do with the different nature of conflict today, how we can better respond to those challenges.
So what message would you like to give to the troops and police contributing countries in ensuring the safety of their peacekeepers, especially their women peacekeepers who are working in hostile environments?
I mean, obviously, the first message is really a message of thanks and gratitude, because those peacekeepers, and including women, are operating often in a more difficult environment. I think that in most peacekeeping operations, you've seen this political and security environment deteriorate. But the second message is that we are there as UN Secretariat to support them. We work very closely with our member states. We count on them, particularly those important troop and police contributing countries such as India, to sort of continue the good work so that we can improve their safety and security, improve their resilience, and of course, they're welcome to provide us with their feedback and their proposals, because they have a wealth of experience. We want to take advantage of that.
Under Secretary General of Peace Operations Jean-Pierre Lacroix, speaking with Anshu Sharma from the United Nations News about women and the importance of having more women in peacekeeping missions in the United Nations. And that is all we have time for today in this edition of Culture and Society. Until next week at the same time, my name is Kanyan Tagodfrey Kampamba.
And now, news for young people.
Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali. In this edition, you can hear from two young climate activists who are nearing the end of their tenure on the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change, Fatou Jang from The Gambia and Benjamin Strzelecki from Poland have been speaking to UN News' Pierre Blondel about what they've achieved.
What was the moment that made you both realize you had to take action on climate change?
Thank you. So there wasn't a single moment. It was a culmination of different experiences that actually really inspired me to get involved in the climate space, because I'm a daughter of a farmer. And I live in a country that is experiencing sea level rise, drought and heat wave, among other environmental conditions. So seeing that at a young age, how climate change actually impacted the main source of income for my father and our family actually inspired me in getting in the climate space.
So in my case, I was always a person who is interested in science. It's just crystal clear that our planet is on a pathway towards a very uninhabitable state. And this in itself should be a wake-up call for all of us. So for me, just being attuned and sensitive towards what science is telling us, towards how we need to change how our economies function and how we live our lives, has been enough to really prompt me to try to take action in whatever way is possible.
Fast forward to now, looking back over your journey, what has made you truly feel like your activism was having an impact?
I feel almost every single activity I do at the local level makes me feel like that our work has significant impact. When I was in the Gambia, I was at the Banjul Beach, and that was a place that we actually planted over 12,000 coconut trees because, as I've mentioned, my city is vulnerable to rising sea level, and we will be inundated under a 1 meter sea level rise. So when I went to the beach and I saw the trees that we planted 4 years ago, and I saw people playing football there, having their sport activities, families having picnics, it actually really was an inspiring moment for me because I could see firsthand the impact of our work and how families, young people and communities are really just reaping the benefit of that. So it's always the impactful work that we do, supporting communities, mobilizing action and inspiring change.
So for me, I have been involved in international youth climate movement for 5 years now. And area of action that I've been particularly passionate about is creating opportunities for young people to make sure that they have the resources to scale up their impact locally. One of particular moments that I recall is back during COVID when everything was online. One of the youth networks that I was a part of, we created this online mentoring network where we connected young entrepreneurs with UN agencies and intergovernmental agencies that are active in the energy transition space. I remember talking to One Youth Initiatives from Argentina that was working on scaling up local solar energy installations. And what they said is that before, no one took them seriously. They were going to local government, municipalities. No one really wanted to work with them. Once the local authorities learned that they gained some recognition on the international stage, suddenly they started getting contracts. They started getting opportunities. They were recognized in local press. And I think this is the role of youth groups like ours, the Youth Advisory Group, to really try to find ways and uplift those who already make a change locally.
That's really interesting. Fatou, with Clean Earth Gambia, which you created in 2017, you've worked directly with young people and communities, as you've said. What's something about the lived reality of those communities facing climate change so directly that you wish more people in global spaces like the UN or even people who are not so confronted with these issues understood better?
So for me, at Clean Earth Gambia, working with young people, children and women over the years, climate change has significantly affected our main source of income and livelihood. Gambia is a country where about 70% of our rural population depend on agriculture. And Gambia, again, is a country where many, many young women are engaged in agriculture or horticultural activities. And these are our mothers, our sisters, that actually wake up as early as 4 a.m. to go to the market to sell their produce to be able to also support their families. But over the years, we've seen, as a result of the impact of climate change, a decline also affecting the basic source of income for these women. In addition, when you look at education, when climate disasters occur and causes flooding, among others, children don't go to school. Because I live in Banjul, when it rains, it absolutely floods. Like all the houses in our neighborhoods, they float. People have to take bucket and fetch the water out to be able to take it out of their living rooms and their bedrooms. Every single rainy season, families are displaced. Families actually have to find temporary accommodations because they cannot inhabit in their own house. But at the end of the day, I always say it's not always about the impacts that we are facing, but how do we make sure we're empowering communities to be able to build their adaptation skills and be empowered to be able to ensure that they are at least mitigating and adapting. For example, with the small-scale farmers, we've provided some level of funding, etc. For instance, I know Benji works on energy access and energy efficiency, but energy access is something that's very crucial. You know, Gambia is one of the countries that actually benefits a lot from solar, from the sun. So how do we make sure we're harnessing these resources that we have to provide employment for young people through the energy sector or energy transition, among others?
When you've brought those stories to Global Spaces, do you feel they resonated with decision makers?
I think they do, because at the end of the day, some of these decision makers are from the same part of the world that we are from. It's about the political will. How are they making sure that they're using their political, you know, positions to influence changes, to influence action? And I think that is where it matters the most. If they listen and they don't take action, then at the end of the day, that's not what we hope to achieve.
That was Fatou Jiang from The Gambia. Before her, you heard from Benjamin Strzelecki from Poland. And that's all for this edition. Till the same time next week, I am Festus Tarawali.
You have been listening to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio, and I am Johnny Baptist Tomosime. In our next program, at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature, Development and the Economy. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.